First, I want to welcome everyone to our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting live Discord interactive podcast. This aims to cover the burning topics relating to all threat hunting and security stuff that hopefully everyone would like to know about. Just as a reminder, throughout the podcast, we'll be taking comments and questions from our Discord server. So if you want to participate, make sure to sign up using the link in the welcome message. And there will be some also polling stuff that we'll be doing throughout to try to, you know, get a sense on some of the things we're talking about. And so we can kind of hopefully share some interesting stats amongst the listeners as far as what's going on. There also, with every episode that we do live, we do a future cocktail that's in our Discord posted up, and I think it'll be thrown up, in other areas, but it's called the Witch's Brew. It's a bourbon cocktail. It's actually pretty good, but I'm a bourbon fan, so. If you were, joining along, that sounds great and fun. So let's kick off like we have in the past. And that's going to be covering some interesting artifacts. We're going to try to dive into some quick things that we think may be useful for some of you out there. And Lee, I believe you have the first one.
Why am I the first one?
You want me to go first? Don't matter.
No, I got this. All right. So. For my resource and artifact was this whole GitHub repository that I found. Bushido UK has put together some great stuff. Not only about like CTI and threat hunting, but attribution as well. So, and a little bit about it. They are also, I forget their Will Thomas. Is that the right real name? I think so. But they helped write the SANS Forensics 589 Cybercrime Intelligence course. They help instruct it. But some of the repositories that that they recently updated are the Russian APT matrix, which is part of the game being, hey, you know, how do we know who it is and how do we play the attribution game? And what they've done here is they've grouped all the Russian or I should say some of the main Russian groups and broke it down not only by MITRE, but they've provided the intelligence that they have with what tools they use. So look, I'm looking at it right now. But so for credential theft, they're using Mimikatz. For offensive security, they got Metasploit, PowerShell Empire, Lulbenz, they got, some Windows event utility stuff going on there. And then the other one that I really enjoyed that I'm actually like looking through right now is the ransomware toolkit. So same idea where they took the groups, or the ransomware groups like Black Suit, Black Basta, Scattered Spider, and they did the same thing. They looked at the capabilities of the group. They looked at the tools that they're using, and they mapped them to MITRE and provided some information about it. Also, they provide the report that exists or the articles that they're pulling this information from. So I always enjoy and I always appreciate when it is, trust but verify, and then they give you the source to verify for it. So it's not just here it is. But this is some great intelligence, especially if cybercrime targets everyone. Being targeted by a Russian APT kind of is a privilege for the government and for big corporations, but cybercrime kind of aims at everyone else first, and targets a lot more other people, because they're just trying to make a quick buck. So taking this intelligence, looking at the tools they use, digging into those tools, finding the capabilities of those tools, and using other resources, like actually going to the MITRE ATT&CK matrix and looking at the capabilities of the software that's documented there, then you can really take that information and make it actionable in your environment. So now you're looking for some serious stuff with a group focus attempt. So if someone does approach you and say, what are you hunting for? You say, well, we're looking for Scattered Spider. Well, how are you doing it? And you start, laying all these resources out, talking about techniques, talking about sub-techniques, command line arguments, and so on. Then it's kind of like this is what we're doing now versus them kind of tell you what to do. I always feel like the more information you have to back up your efforts, the more they'll trust you, but also keep their hands out of the pot. If, you know, if upper management comes in and asks you, well, you doing? And they're like, oh, just scattered spider. And they're like, well, how are you doing that? And you can't really answer it. Then there's that sense that they're going to start telling you what to do. And you might not want that. But these are like some really good, and these are just two of the repositories that they have. There's a lot of good ones, a lot of CTI stuff, some really good information here. But yeah, what do you guys think?
I mean, right off the bat, my favorite thing is when you do a matrix like this, you get so much more bang for your buck when you are able to see what overlaps, especially amongst common threat actors. So it's much easier when you're like responsible for teeing up against, you know, or having answers for, say, ransomware groups. You can say, well, we focus on these three or four things right out of the gate. Right, because it's all of them are using this, so we get kind of, I guess, the most coverage by solving these first than doing other things. So that I really like structures like that. And of course, I'm a huge fan of collecting resources on GitHub when people list our resources. That's just how often do I dig through all of them? I don't really have the time all the time, but you know, knowing that those resources exist, so that when I'm like, well, what do I do next? I have places to go, so it's always good.
It's never a bad thing to have too much intel. Or too many resources, right? It's bad if you don't have enough.
Yeah, absolutely. So I believe my stuff is kind of listed second. Let me go ahead and share these. So the sources I found and why I like them is, and it was kind of ironic how I found them, because it's a Salesforce kind of push thing. Which didn't really fall in the lines of necessarily cybersecurity type stuff that I was kind of the way I was looking at it. But they basically have this open source tool where they put together all these different ways to just analyze like a set of logs. And I think this is really important, because when you think about some of the log sources that you're responsible for understanding, it's good to get a shakedown of, well, what are just the common noise threads that happen within the data, or what are some of the rare things that we see? And so it does a lot of statistical analysis. It does clustering. It kind of does a rough parsing, which I actually haven't played with it. I've just like kind of looked at tutorials and how people have used it. But what I like is, I think, especially when you're supposed to be defending and responding to alerts based off a data set that you're not too familiar with, I think it's a great way to either evaluate a data source if there's any value, but two, help you understand what is actually in your data source. And you know, start from an approach that kind of helps break it down to what may be important. So that's kind of why this tool came to light for me, because I love digging into data and I think it's really good to understand data. But yeah, I think it's worth checking out. I'm planning on, I wish they had a Docker instance so I can spin this up quick and actually kind of play with some data sources. But it didn't look like anyone's built one of those yet that I'm aware of. But they have really good documentation about it. So that's what the two links, one is actual repository, the other is documentation. So yeah, I think it's worth checking out if you want to do some things with data to help you understand it better. I don't know if you guys took a gander.
So what I heard you say was that you haven't built a Docker image yet with it. And
just add that to my list.
Yeah, right. Like how much? No, yeah. I honestly, I didn't get to take a look at it. I am looking at it right now. But if I know anyone that can take this that and all that data and information and make it not only pretty but even useful, it's you.
Yeah, it builds visuals around it, right? So that's like a big win already. For people that don't want to look at things line by line, right, from that perspective. So
yeah, I'm that super basic dude.
That was in the play into that. That's kind of one of the things I thought was interesting about this is it seems relatively and yeah, like you can get entry into it pretty quickly. It's broken out pretty good. It's got a couple of these anomaly detection modules that are already stocked and the GUI to help represent the data pretty quickly. So yeah, I'm interested to see what you come up with when you dive into this, Scott, and looking forward to that Docker image you're gonna build.
We're yeah. All waiting on you, Pulley.
No pressure. Jeez, guys. That we're on the same team.
We are. We're just waiting for you to carry your load.
Yeah. All right. So, what do you got?
Sure, what do you got?
Yes, I'm up. So I'm going to go ahead and share I can see in this whole get up here. I'm going to share a little article here, a little blog article out of the detect.fyi blog. Personally a fan of that, of this blog, of this repo. A lot of good articles come out of this that I find very interesting. They touch on a lot of different topics. In particular, you know, around the whole idea of detections and hunts and SOC and things like that. But this one, you know, I think will arch into our main topic today pretty well. And it's an article titled, Have You Been Keeping Up With Your Low Confidence Detections? Basically, you know, the quick and dirty is written by Gary Katz. This talks about, you know, the value of those low fidelity, high rate alerts that you can get in a SOC. I think Scott and Lee, you both are ultra familiar with it like I am. And generally, I think in by and large, people generally turn their nose down to it, right? It's like, man, lots of false positives. You consider burnout rate for your analyst, things like that. But there are some good points made in this post here. And then a couple other things I thought to add to it is, you know, what the value of having those detections are, what value you can gain, what might not necessarily be those things that I think all SOCs or people that are generating security detections go to look for with those high validity, you know, almost always a true positive alerts, which are great. But these low and bulky ones, you don't necessarily have to react to them all. You can do a lot of things like aggregating them up. You can understand some of the depth around attacks. There's a part in this article or in this post that talks about how you tend to get caught up when you're looking at those high value, almost always true positive, and an analyst or a security team is generally going to move to remediate right away, right? That you want to take action right away. Generally, that's always the case. And this makes a really good point about those low and slows are those little alerts that might be around that main true positive one. We might miss. You might not consider it. You might not see what else could have happened or what else might have happened. So there's value there. And, you know, additionally, the value in the, from the security, the engineer, the detection engineers or the people building the content, you can get a good idea for what's actually occurring in your environment, where you can tune things back, where you can, aggregate things in a different way. You know, there's all sorts of ideas here, and this one really scratched the surface and, you know, leads in the, like, in my head, kind of like how we get started threat hunting. So I don't know. Curious what you guys thought.
I mean, my quick stab at it, when I saw some of this, it made me immediately think of why I like to build detections from threat hunts, because you've kind of done a pretty good exploration and tuning to validate, should we even be detecting on this? And threat hunting gives you that alternative option where it's like, ooh, this is really interesting, but it's not something we can just create alerts off and send them somewhere for people to respond to. Maybe we hunt more for this type of thing versus making detections. So it gives you, because if you're just focused on building detections and you're like, well, I mean, it works when it happens, then it's kind of like, well, maybe we should have it up there so that we could just look at it and investigate them and we'll find the one that actually matters. Like that, you know, doesn't give you the alternative path to potentially solve kind of looking for the same types of behaviors that you might be able to be successful with threat hunting. So it kind of go both ways.
So absolutely. Like one of the things that we teach that I teach in my training that we do is that promoting a hunt to a detection is a good thing. Detection engineering and threat hunting should never be seen as a competitive process. They complement each other. They're just doing it in different ways. But by the way, I had to copy and paste this version of the Pyramid of Pain. I really like it.
Yeah, that was pretty good too.
Right, like, but you know, and threat hunting takes time. If you are working on this on a hunt, and you're searching and searching and searching, and you're creating all these exclusions, you're weeding out false positives, why keep that to yourself? Why not hand that over to the security operations center team? Now, something also that we talk about is, but one of the things I always say is, you can automate the hunt. Don't automate the decision-making process or the analyst. You need that human aspect. So but what I'm tying into is, if you have a saved search or a capability in your tool that you can save a search and run it later, go ahead and do that. But set it to low confidence. Set it to email you the results. Can't handle it, Polly.
One eye is not working.
You know, like set it to low confidence so that you're not alerting the security operations center on a something that you're just testing out. right? Like, if you know that it's going to return a lot of false positives, have it email you the results or provide you a link to the query so that when you click the link, you get the results. But yeah, I like the, until you know what you're doing, then, you know, once you work on that low and keep polishing and polishing and polishing, then you might eventually have that, that nice clean detection that you're looking for.
All right. So I think that, you know, the purpose of that for those that are listening, right, is we just really want to provide some resources that people either can learn, grow, play with, that may actually add some value. Because I'm just a big proponent of finding resources myself, whether I visit them commonly or not, or use them commonly, it's just nice to have certain things so that it becomes part of my tool set in a way when I'm trying to solve problems and I'm looking for solutions. But the one thing we really want to cover, the main topic tonight, since we're kind of kicking off season two of this live edition, is really to jump in to the journey of what it means to be a threat hunter. And kind of like, what does it mean to start out in threat hunting, right? Or, and how was that for us to have experience doing it? And then, you know, transition to basically what I call the grind, where once you kind of establish what you're doing, you know, what is it about the grind, that we can learn from each other about, you know, before, and how to perfect that, I guess, in a way where it doesn't just feel like a grind all the time. And then kind of discuss, like, if at the end of the journey, I'm not saying the journey is just going to end, but when you're threat hunting, what is the outcome of that? What is it once you've established that, you know, you've learned how to threat hunt, you've matured in threat hunting, what is it you want to achieve? And hopefully provide for the function of, you know, the group you're kind of working with and working for. And so one of the things I kind of want to start off with the beginning journey, right? Was kind of, I'll start with you, Tom. I could pivot over to you, Lee, based on what you think. And that is, what kind of was or is your relationship to cybersecurity in general? And how did you view it back when you kind of, were just getting your feet wet when it came to possible threat hunting and things like that? Or just cyber, or like, how did you function in cybersecurity to begin with? Because we all kind of started somewhere, right? So, take that away, Tom, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, early on, it was like, okay, this brand new world, this thing that, you know, you watch the movies, you see hackers like everybody else, right? You want to find the guy that had the password of God and just kind of, you know, go down that road. You know, it's interesting how it's developed, though, because so much of that is actually still true. And, you know, the idea of how it's transitioned, like, from the very beginning of entry into cybersecurity, where, like, I had no idea what I was doing, till now, which I still have no idea what I'm doing. And in an understanding, like, looking back, like, how much I was doing in the beginning that was legitimately threat hunting, right? And I think you guys probably agree with that, too. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of excitement still, even a decade into this field, where it constantly grows. It's so exciting to see where we're going with some of this stuff. Threat hunting is an absolute enjoy. I absolutely love doing it. But, you know, I don't know, Lee, what do you think?
So, to be honest, I thought I was threat hunting before I even learned what threat hunting was. Then I just realized I was just messing around in logs. And chasing, you know, wild geese and stuff. But so no, I love how I got there. And what I've learned that it is, both of you know, cause you were there whenever I found Syswan. The one reference that I'll always mention is the JP cert, tool Fine. Analysis sheet. That was the start of my threat hunting journey. Cause I think for those of you who don't know, Poli was my supervisor at my first, security operations center. Tom was his, like, right-hand man whenever it came to talking and, the idea, man, I remember being on shift on the weekend and you two in the war room in there just doing things. So it was, like, amazing.
I just bring the input face, man. That's it. Just bring the input face.
Dude, that's just where the whiteboard were.
or did you just stick around for the button?
Yeah, that's where the whiteboard was.
But no, like, I was responding to alerts and doing, like, little investigations, but then I found this how to look at normal stuff from a log perspective. And at the same point in time, I was just like, well, what does that mean? Why am I looking at the normal stuff? And then as I continued my journey down the road, I continued to read intel reports and process them, I realized the reason I'm doing that is because the bad guys are now using, they're using the good stuff, the stuff that legitimately exists. But since like I got to that point, I think I threat hunted for a while. Yeah, that's what we won. When we got to that point where I thought I knew what I was doing, and then I got to Cyborg and got under this leadership to explain it all, it was just like, wow, like a whole new world. Let's look at all these different things. Great leadership again. I think that's my best thing about my career has been there's always been awesome leadership that I've fallen under. But it's just been amazing. Like, yeah, you love it, you hate it, because sometimes like it's really complicated, it's hard work. But whenever you get to that point where you figure things out, it's just, it's great.
Yeah, my kind of like my brief answer, what was interesting was my relationship to cybersecurity, just because it was kind of what was bred based on the technology we use, was you show up, you kind of just, the tasks didn't really necessarily make sense for what to do when you're not responding to security stuff based on our responsibilities. So I was just waiting for alerts and technology to tell me what to do. And it felt so empty when I was starting out, because it was like, well, if something's not telling me what to do, what do I do? And I started to see a slight different approach working with, and I know you guys remember Andrew Foster, but I remember his early days starting, and, you know, he had some former cyber military background. He was bored, too, because there weren't alerts firing right away, and he was starting to look for things. And they weren't necessarily looking for adversarial behaviors, but he just really wanted to understand the environment. So he's kind of discovering things. And the first thing he looked at was, well, gosh, you know, I know FTP has been taken advantage of in the past. Do we even have FTP or FTP communications happening on the network kind of thing? And he, like, just uncovered, you know, stuff by doing that. And it wasn't necessarily about discovering specific threats. But then I was like, oh, you know, there's actually things we could do with data at that point. But my relationship with cybersecurity had nothing to do with any kind of proactive, I guess, activity. It was really just about, well, how do I get smarter about the things I am investigating and have the tools tell me where to look next, which I can see how that can be either one, a defeating, but also not bring a lot of success as an individual and to the organization, unless you have the most perfect detections in the world, which I wouldn't want to gamble my money on. So.
You think that's how you discovered how to threat hunt, or did that come later?
No, the concept definitely came later, but I did start to appreciate that, yeah, we should be doing things, what those things were. I wasn't quite sure what they were, but we should be doing some more proactive type activities, right? Yeah.
No, absolutely. And I think my biggest issue was that I think it was like for the first 3 years I was drinking from a fire hose. I was trying to learn all that and get smarter and smarter. And at that point, I was in no position like to get there, right? And that's probably the hard part about cybersecurity, especially coming from a network admin perspective. I'm going from operational to keep things up and talking to security to make
sure.
It's
a common transition for people, right? A lot of people go through that transition of like keep things working versus security stuff.
Right. So it was tough. But once you like, I feel like once you got your head above water, it was not easier because it's still rough. It still takes a lot of time and effort, but it was a clearer view of things, I guess.
So Tom, when you talk about like, is that what you thought, like, did I discover threat hunting the first, like, is that how I discovered threat hunting, right? Through that whole process. And I said, no, I'm curious from your perspective, how did you really discover threat hunting?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know it at the time, but looking back to, looking back to how it started and what it was basically, hey, you're a security analyst now. Here's a SIM. Here's a bunch of data. We don't know what it's telling us. We don't know what these alerts from the SIM, the out-of-the-box stuff, are telling us. Go do security things. That was basically the entry, right? It was like, sit down, go figure out and do security things. I feel like it was out of the gate and I didn't know it. I feel like I was starting to be trained to threat hunt immediately, day one, as soon as they sat me in front of that, all these log sources, all this different data, whether it was the raw logs behind it or the parse logs inside of the SIM, at that point, and that's to me, that's what it looked like. I mean, the first thing you started hunting for was they say, okay, well, let's prioritize web gateway logs, right? What looks weird? Like, oh, okay. I mean, believe it or not, without a general hypothesis, that's still a threat hunt start, I think. I would imagine you guys agree. In my head, I believe that. And it's just like, I don't know what I'm looking for, so I'd start figuring it out. I'd start finding some intelligence to help guide me. I'd start scouring the internet to say, well, what does this mean? How do you look through this stuff? What's bad? Had some ideas, but didn't really know. But yeah, I feel like it all started day one, man. The first time I sat down in a security analyst seat.
So
that's lucky.
Yeah, for me, I literally need to be like shown the concept, because I'm kind of the person that like if I can see what the results I should be looking for, or what it is that I'm actually trying to solve, because just finding bad kind of that was too general of a problem to try to solve, right? And I went to a training really to kind of show me this, and I give Route 9B the credit for opening my eyes. It was just a random training at a random conference I went. Michael Morris taught it, fantastically smart guy. And then we got training because of that. I was so impressed by that. I worked really hard to try to get training for our folks. Aaron Shaha, I want to say his name was James McCarthy, if I'm getting that correct, I feel bad if I don't. He was the other guy. And, they were kind of former NSA, did threat hunting from like that, advanced adversarial threat perspective. And so there were two things they showed me or made me think about. One was, you really are dealing, and a lot of times, with another person on the other end. And so it made me really think about, I'm not just dealing with computer code that I'm trying to compete with and it's embedding and hiding in different ways. I'm really dealing with activities that people are performing, and people are, creatures of habit. People have their flaws, preferences, biases, specific knowledge bases. And by profiling, when I look at threat reports and things that way, it kind of helps me pull out like, yeah, if this person were to do this activity again, I could see them repeating these few steps, because that just seems like, and especially if I have more than one report that confirms that, it's like, well, that's just how they do it. From that perspective, but they also got a really good taste of, hey, there's a lot of things you could do with data that isn't just the data that you collect. And so then it started really getting, it's what I think it also, what baptized me into a data junkie today. And that was the simple process where they were showing us, hey, if you want to just find really interesting things in your proxy data, what URLs and domains are people going to? They took the Alexa top billion at the time. And at that time, it was a novel approach. I know other people were doing it, later down the line as I talked to them, but it's basically saying, let's take the Alexa top million and basically pull those domains out, which is basically, when you think of the Alexa ranking, for people that don't know, it is the ranking to say how popular is a site for people to go to. And so the likelihood of it actually being malicious is incredibly low unless it's compromised. So because most malicious URLs aren't the most popular sites, now when you strip those out of your data set, now you have a data set that's more refined and you're kind of like hunting for those things. And that was a huge eye opener for like a couple different approaches for how to think about threat hunting. Now, I never got into like a procedural approach and kind of what we do today. But that, what I say, is like the first emerging, hey, this is how I think about this problem. And it was kind of trained in me a little bit, but it also just made so much sense at the same time.
So that was the beginning of your journey into data?
Yeah, no, that's when the waterfall of data effect hit me. Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Poli loves Log4j, Neo4j.
Yeah.
And the stuff he's produced over the past couple of years, in different details and different perspectives, looking at security, looking at data differently. I mean, you've used what, Bloodhound? What other tools have you blown up? But the relationships that he can find in data, it makes the Charlie from Always Sunny in Philadelphia, or Always Sunny in...
That's your comparison.
Hey, Sylvia. That pays.
It's like that meme with the yarn. Like, he makes that look like child's play. Like, it's amazing. Yeah, good comparison, Bat. Yeah. It's a compliment. Boy, take it.
I'll take it.
But that's cool. I'll tell you what, you did say something, and I was trying to... Oh, the beginning of threat hunting. I don't think I got to that point until you put me on the content detection engineering team, or the detection engineering team. I think once you pulled me into there, out of the investigations, or not out of the investigations, but you gave me the responsibility to say...
Focus, yeah.
to look at things differently. It's not just an alert that can't be changed. It's something that you can mold to fit into it. It's that whole idea. I think that's where it started, because after a while I started thinking, I was like, well, why do we have to wait? And like, I think you point out too, like, why do we have to wait for this? Like, why can't we find something without waiting for, without these conditions being met? What can we look for? And I think that's where it peaked. And then I left. With all that information in my head.
You're like, I'm out. I got it.
Yeah. I got a great idea. See ya. But no.
Tom, you're the one that was so blessed with just knowing how to thread hunt right out of the gate. So what was the first thing you actually hunted for?
I think it was the web gateway stuff. You know, I think that was the first thing. I'm still going to attribute it back to that because, you know, it was like looking at a whole data set of not knowing what specifically I'm looking for, right? Coming in with no real hypothesis, just trying to look for anomalies. And this is not detection based. This is right. Just dive into a log, a log source and stream the data and see what you see, run reports, et cetera. That was really the first, in the simplest form right out of the gate. It was like, okay, well, I have no idea what I'm looking for, but I got to start doing something with this data to formulate it in a way that I can, ingest, right? So it's like, okay, here's 10 million lines of whatever. It's like, okay, well, how about we change that up? Let's start looking at some of the tops and bottoms. Like, what are the noisiest things? What might I be able to calculate as normal? And I actually walked down that path to try to sort through the data to see what I was going to find. That was very quickly identified as that's going to take way too long. So start from the bottom, right? What are the rare things? And it was funny how quickly we actually found some meat there, right? It's like, oh, wait, there's some things here that are interesting and you can start pivoting from and start seeing what's actually happening. I know that's a really simple answer, but that was the first hunt because it was blind. It was just a set of data and it was find something bad.
Yeah. I remember doing the same thing because like we discussed earlier, I was obsessed with data in a way. So I wanted to find the easy, quick wins, and definitely looking for rare things was an obvious answer for adversaries that didn't take the care it took to kind of blend in. But as we all know, probably from when we all worked together till today, lull bins became more of a thing, right? And so that was more of a way to kind of blend in. But in that, one of the things I remember, and I wasn't savvy with PowerShell. Like, I knew what PowerShell was, and I could probably get away with using pieces of it, but if you wanted me to write like a true script at that time, I don't think I could. But the one thing from taking that approach I described earlier where, I was thinking about there's a human on the other end and they have different skills and different things that they do time in and time out. And that was comparing reports and seeing PowerShell is being utilized. And, the one thing that I did know just from trying to play with PowerShell in our environment is we tried pretty hard to kind of lock it down. But so then I knew if it was pretty locked down to where you'd have to be pretty smart in order to even get it to run what you needed to run, that means it probably wasn't that common in the environment. So I kind of leveraged like what I knew and kind of what I saw at the same time. And I remember saying, you know, trying to answer the question, well, gosh, who runs PowerShell? And what was interesting was, you know, the tough answers where I get back people in IT and I'm like, well, crap, now is that a bad or a good thing? I don't think we had PowerShell login enabled. And at this time, I don't even think PowerShell logging existed like it did today, because I don't know if that was an added thing or we discovered it. I'm not really sure, because I know like PowerShell version 5 or whatever, it's V5 or something like that, that now enables logging. But I think at the time it was V2 that existed in the environment. What's that?
Even so, I mean, if you're talking about a similar area we existed in, even so, it was probably hard as hell to ingest, even if it was available.
Right. So it was one of those things where like, okay, now if I saw people using it, I didn't really know how to answer that question. But when I started seeing things like HR using PowerShell, or, you know, because I basically dumped where's PowerShell running and what users were doing it and enriching the users and kind of did that exercise, and I was able to start finding things that didn't make sense. And I'll be honest, I want to say there's a couple one-offs where I did reach out, like, hey, you know, I see this kind of activity, you know, do you use PowerShell in your function or your job? And one guy was like, well, yeah, I use it for it. He was like, clearly just a really smart dude that just simplified his job by using something that he knew how to use. But there are people that did not. And so already it was like, well, gosh, if you don't use it and we don't use it, you know, throughout our enterprise very much, immediately I was able to then pivot and find things that were of interest, right? And to me, that was probably the first time I did something that was not so much hypothesis driven, because we always say this is what's happening and we're going to prove it or disprove it, right? It was more like, I'm just curious. And I want to say, when it comes to threat hunting or security in general, I mean, had conversations with the conference that I'm talking to people at this week about what makes a good security practitioner, offensive or defensive, and curiosity is like a main thread. And so, yeah, curiosity is what made me successful, at least in that attempt and approach and whatever. So, yeah.
So your first hunt was an unstructured hunt.
Yeah, it was less structured. So it was interesting, because my very, very first stuff of doing rarity definitely was unstructured. It was more like statistical based, right? And I think I was slowly structuring it as I was maturing with the concept and kind of developing some of those ideology skills, or whatever you want to call them.
That's actually ironic, because the Cleveland ISS is the talk that, or is the conference that's near us. And I actually gave a presentation today about structured versus unstructured hunts.
Yeah.
And people were asking the main question, that's letting the data drive you is like that unstructured, like, let me look at my environment kind of deal, where a structured hunt is that hypothesis driven type idea. Like, hey, you know, I want to, my hypothesis, I think PowerShell encoded commands are happening in my environment. Let's go see if it's there, versus who uses PowerShell. You went the hard way, as usual. I think I remember that. I don't remember the hunt. I remember you trying to get PowerShell working in our environment. Because do you remember the spreadsheet that Frisco gave us with all those Cisco devices?
Yeah.
And then I tried to hand.
So that was Python. Which also was a pain because of how I had to code to make that work. But yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
I remember that. It was a race to see if I could hand jam credentials or he could automate it. Yeah, that was, I thought that's where you're going. Then I forgot that was Python.
Yeah.
The one.
I did find an interesting way to circumvent PowerShell controls for people that maybe want to do PowerShell things, but they're restricted and don't know how to beat it. There's a really powerful commandlet called git content. As long as your code that you want to run is in a file and you can say git content and then pipe it to whatever, ironically, it will just read in the code as if you're typing it, and now you're running that script without any, you know. So once again, controls.
Your text editor is Notepad.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Now, so like, there are some ways to get around it. There's some batch things or big code blocks that you want to run that you know will work for certain purposes. That was one way I got around it, because I just remember like, oh yeah, no, we locked that down. I'm like, well, that's weird. I just did like one extra change to how I ran it. Boom. So, but it does prevent other ways of running it. So not saying the controls are worthless, but understanding how the controls work is important, right? So, yeah, Lee, I see you got a question.
I was just digging that out. Because I know the answers that I hear, from speaking to our customers. I have this preconceived notion already that I know the answer, what they have. But I gotta ask the question. What's the biggest challenge to you when you're exposed to threat hunting? Like, what is it? Like, what's the real hang up, or what's the biggest hurdle that you gotta get over, or you've had to get over, to be successful in threat hunting?
I mean, I would say there's like two major challenges that were hard for me. And the first was how I consumed information about security threats, because every time I got a report or something that I should care about, and I immediately wanted to say, did this affect us? I only could somehow see the IOCs associated with that threat, so I can answer that question very easily. And it was really hard to be like, well, is there anything else you would look for? I'm like, well, why would I? We're not affected by this if we don't see any of these hashes, any of these IPs at all. And it was really hard for me to like make my mind pivot to what does a behavior look like and how do I pull that out of intelligence? And I think part of that problem really stems from my second challenge, which was just understanding how things work, right? I feel like as I started to understand, you know, what was normal in the environment, how operating systems really function, what were like, tangent to that, I remember we were looking at doing some machine learning based parent child process stuff to see if we can discern our own stuff with AI and making decisions. And we literally looked at data sets for what does a computer look like at boot from a process perspective? What does it look like when someone logs in from a process perspective? What does it look like when they just do generic work? And it's not like we solved that problem like we, you know, sought out to do necessarily, but I learned so much on how does a system really just run from a process perspective. But like I said, learning how things work then let me understand when I see a report, I can be like, oh, they're doing this. Well, that's definitely not a normal way for those things to execute. That's not a normal thing for like those types of files to exist. So then it made a lot more sense. It made things stand out that I'm sure they're put in the report for a reason, because the people writing them, it either is interesting or it's something to note. But out of the gate, those things now, I almost ignore IOCs when I look at reports because I really care about the behavior side first. And those things just stand out like, oh, yeah, why are they dropping that in the app data folder in that weird directory? Why is a DLL and executable being dropped in like the downloads folder? Like that's just not good. And it's not normal. And the good thing about not normal is it's okay in threat hunting to have false positives, unlike detections and security operation, right? Like you really want to reduce that as much as possible. Well, that's what I like about threat hunting. I'd be like, oh, that's not normal. So it's okay. It's a win if I identified that, because that means I'm actually seeing that behavior. Whether it's malicious or not is a whole nother conversation. But if the fact that I know that's not normal and I can see it now, malicious or not, I can find it, right? And I understand why. So yeah, those are the two challenges I think that I was exposed to. I just lost my hat. All right. I found it.
What about you, Kasura?
And from my side, you know, I'm gonna go into the something else category and be, you know, start from a simple place. Doubt, man. I doubted it the whole thing. You know, that
like
was the biggest challenge.
Overcoming you.
Just the idea that I could get into this data and figure out how to find the thing that I'm looking for, whether
it's
structure, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't count. Imposter syndrome is a built-in function of being a cybersecurity analyst, a threat hunter, or whatever.
That's true. But that, you know, that was when you're sitting there, you know, especially entry level, especially at the beginning.
Especially if you don't find
more in the beginning than ever. Well, you sit down and you're looking at something and you're like, okay, I might not totally understand all this data. right? So I have to figure out what this data is telling me.
Yeah.
I might not totally understand how to navigate the data to sort out what I'm trying to look for. So I have to figure that piece out, right? I have to translate it into what I'm trying to find, or what I do find that might not be the thing I'm looking for, like you had said, right? So you might come up with these other things. Okay, how do I translate that? Maybe you're in a place where you have to deliver on your hunt. So now I have to deliver some kind of a result of what I'm doing and how I'm spending my time doing this hunt while I'm combating these, you know, trying to overcome these hurdles all in flight, all at the same time. And doubting that I could do that was the biggest hurdle. But once you kind of like breach that and you start learning little things, like understanding a general log source, right? Just a simple thing. For me personally, once I started grasping Windows logs really effectively, things started just streamlined and it felt easier to navigate. So
that's why I like that log AI tool I shared, because I felt like if I had that, I would have eaten that up when I had nothing to do.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, half the tools we're using now, if we had 10 years ago, would have been great.
Oh, yeah, sure, 100%.
But no, I mean, it was just internal. I mean, I think threat hunting can be accomplished with just persistence. I mean, you just need a log source. You just need a system, right? Not to oversimplify it, but in a lot of ways, it's true, right? You can go on a single host and hunt for something.
Well, I guess you can.
And then you could expand beyond that.
Yeah, like what you're saying, I don't think you can measure success based on trying and failing, right? Like, I feel like that's why I like when I open this up, I'm giving myself props when I say it like this, right? But I like when I open this up and I called it a journey, because that's kind of really what it is, right? Yeah, you guys, I already patted myself on the back. I don't need any of this going on over here. but yeah, like, it's something that, you know, I say journey because it's really not about winning and losing. It's the ride, right? And then what I've seen from every security professional that's adopted this kind of approach, especially when it comes to threat hunting, at the end of that tunnel, there are success stories. And like, how many, I mean, that's environment dependent to some degree, because it depends on the data you have and depends on the understanding of threats and the data you have. And also depends on, do you have threats in your environment, right? So I don't think you can use success in the ways of finding things as a measure. Are you a good threat hunter? Because some of those variables you can't control. So, but the journey is really important. And the fact that you're able to basically ask questions and answer questions successfully, and if you can do it with confidence and speed, I mean, that's a win in my game.
It's like the whole thing, like, what is it? Success isn't determined by how many times you've won, but how many times you've fallen and gotten back up. I mean, yeah, it's not as quite as drastic as that. But yeah, if you don't find anything and you don't find anything, you don't find anything, it's easy to doubt yourself. It's easy to get down and say, I'm not good. But like you said, answer questions.
When you drop a quote like that, looking like a coach for a basketball team, it has so much more impact, as if like you're just like building up the team, getting them ready to perform. I like it.
Should I get a clipboard too?
Yeah,
man, I'm ready for the breakdown, man. I'm ready to 1-2-3 team this thing.
Hold on. But I mean, it's a huge problem, or I can't say you're relying on all the knowledge you gained from all your jobs, from all the experiences, and applying that to something that you might not find. I have talked to people in the community. I've talked to people, throughout that say sometimes. Yeah, I'll tell you what's a really tough position is being in an organization that sees this as binary. You find it or you don't. So how can you be successful if you're hunting and hunting and hunting, you don't find anything, and then leadership starts looking down and says, well, you know what? Like, why are we wasting our time?
You just turn on the head. You just tell them it's binary. If you don't make $1 billion this quarter, then you failed. Because, you know, from a business perspective, like, that's like the same measure. Like, hey, did you hit the jackpot this quarter? Well, you didn't. Does that mean you failed? No.
All right, sorry. Pirate. Nobody's down after
you. It's the pirate in me. I can't help it.
It's the pirate and the cocktail, little art.
Yeah, probably all the above. But, yeah. So,
but I think to that point, like, you can really, like this is something I think, too, anyone that is listening, that they can think about that. I'm sure you're preaching this to a lot of the courses and stuff you're doing, Lee. It doesn't have to be, I found the bad thing, right? Necessarily, like a successful hunt could be, I found a gap in our visibility. I now have a better understanding that I can translate to our team of how our environment works and things of the such, right?
Yeah, we like had a think tank about that. Like, how do we communicate? Because, to be honest as well, threat hunting is a lot about communication. You could be the best technical person you can. You could find the worst thing in your environment, but if you can't communicate why it's a threat, why it needs remediating, and so on, then you're not doing your job. So communicating, what a successful outcome is, like Tom said, visibility, finding maliciousness, God forbid you have a visibility gap, or just those administrative issues, and I say issues, but things that are unique to your environment. Like, hey, why is this guy running all these PowerShell encoded commands? Well, that's just how he does it, and they're legitimate, and they work, and they help the business, and you're like, oh, that's weird. Well, okay. So, but,
the one thing that I would challenge a little bit on what you say, I think communication is paramount in general, but I think the one thing that's, I think, unique for threat hunting, and maybe it's just because of how well it's understood, meaning not well, right? I feel like to convey that message with communication, you have to also be like almost a good storyteller, because you almost kind of walk them through the process. Because if you treat threat hunting sometimes, especially if your organization is not a proud supporter and stand behind and understanding the program, and you're just like, hey, we found nothing here, we found five things here, and we did this many hunts, like, that just kind of hits like security operation hits, and it's like, well, gosh, security operations has numbers like 10 times more than that, and they are finding some things, and it just doesn't get weighted the same. And so I feel like the context becomes so much more important. And if you're a good storyteller, I think it's easy to develop some of that. Well, so to flip this, right, we kind of talked about what are the biggest challenges, but when it came to you guys, what was like the biggest strength you guys had that helped you in either exploring or becoming a threat hunter? What about your strengths, if you had any?
If I had any.
Yeah, if you have strengths,
just a wee little person.
I'm the Magikarp of the threat hunting world.
Full of doubt, just trying to hunt. No, I mean, it was, and for me, it was interest. Like, I really, really wanted to understand it. I really wanted to figure it out. Beyond anything, I wanted to catch the bad guy. Like, it was just like this fire that just wouldn't go away. And that, ultimately, pair that with just any level of persistence. And it's like, okay, I'm going to do it. It doesn't matter if I have to sort through an Excel sheet of this data to sort to figure it out. I'm going to do it. I'm going to find this. So for me, it was just like, the persistence and I really, really was interested in it. I really wanted to understand it. I want to understand how these things worked. I wanted to understand how I could find the bad guy. That helped me move through the challenge of doubt and, ultimately start really gaining experience and learning and learning the craft.
I think it's Tom's a persistence of trying to find what I'm looking for, and through emulation, through testing and everything. And also, go ahead.
I was going to say, is that persistence that you and Tom describe, is that just like your character, or is there something about just the job that kind of created that persistence? Like what made you guys persistent, I guess?
I think it's just
people might give up.
I think it's got to be a bit of both. Because I feel like, being military, and you could probably attest this as well.
Yeah.
Being persistent to get a job done was needed. You couldn't just walk away and say, I almost got it, or I was almost there, or I can't figure this out. It was kind of molded at a young, early, young 20s.
This is kind of how you operated.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, now that I'm here, granted, I'm not going to have to do push-ups, or I'm not going to get, crushed physically for not, but it's also something inside of me where I can't walk away for something that I put so much time and effort in, without an answer. Like, I need to know that. And I guess it's also my, I don't know if this is a good thing, but my persistence to get an answer, even if I break things and leave it in a, fire heap.
Yo, I could relate to that answer.
Well, I'll tell you what. The one thing that I remember, and some knowledge that I learned, and I learned it and forgot it, but I was looking for registry keys. I was looking for a specific registry key, but it wouldn't show up in the log properly. And I kept trying, and I kept trying, and I kept turning on auditing here, turning on auditing there, and everything. But I just couldn't find it. Finally, I did like global auditing on registry keys, which, and we have a lab, so it's like VMs, right? I think I have, what, eight gigs of RAM, maybe? But I turned on all the auditing on all the registry keys at the highest level, because I'm going to find this thing, which I eventually did. But it's like smoking this VM. It's always at like the peak CPU. And our engineer, Alex, was always like, what's going on with your VM? What's up, Lee? I was like, well, you don't know me, but check this out. And then, of course, I saved it, or somehow I saved it as a snapshot instead of just, you know, reverting. So every time I turn it on, it's smoking. And by the way, all these logs are getting shipped into Splunk. So in the first, like, 15 minutes, you get millions of registry keys from me.
You really know how to leave a mark.
But I found what I was looking for. So
great job. Great job, Luke.
The curiosity and the not worrying about breaking things.
Yeah, I feel like my side, I'm just stubborn. I'm Irish and I'm stubborn, but I some parallels to Lee for sure. I wanna figure it out, but you know, I think in my experience, just from my perspective, you know, the threat hunting side.
Yeah.
You have to be that way a bit, because I just don't think there's really much from a threat hunting side that can just always be or really be proceduralized, right? So you're kind of in this free fall mode when you're going through hunts in a lot of ways. I think even with a strong structured hunt, you're still going to run into some curveballs or some hurdles, whether it's, okay, I can't figure out how to emulate data, or there's something missing on this machine, or there's something missing in the lab, or there's something missing in my environment. There's log data I'm not seeing. You know, you're going to run into hurdles that just aren't going to be top down. And, you know, I've seen people that have tried to go into threat hunts with like a good hypothesis or a strong structure, and they hit that wall. It's just not for them, right? Like they hit that gap. It's like, man, it's just too frustrating. So it's almost like you got to be stubborn and almost, yeah, I don't know. You just got to be willing to smack your head on those bricks a little bit to kind of power through to that, you know? I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. I'd like to think it's part of my character. I'd like to give myself those props, but I don't know.
I was just saying, like,
Tyson's the best. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face.
They get punched in the face, exactly.
I just appreciate that you guys pretty much summed up how I thought about you guys. Rick, very stubborn, will just break stuff, you know? Like, you know, it all started to make sense as far as, like, why I have these opinions of you guys. But yeah, no, my biggest strength kind of aligns with some of your guys' as well in some aspects. And one of them is, I mean, I just have this natural curiosity when, like, something is in front of me that is complex or just does something really cool or actually does something. I want to know how it works. Like, I can almost care less about the result of like, oh man, when I hit this power key, look what happens. Like, I just want to understand things. Like, I don't know. It's just, that's like a huge curiosity and fascination of mine. And I think that lends itself so much because, like there are things that I dig into that I'll learn about, and just that little bit of knowledge carries over into so many other things that I do. Right. So it's like, it's not just wasted effort. But the other thing, from a biggest strength perspective, is I think I'm being competitive. Like, I think, like I mentioned earlier, being introduced to threat hunting and the idea that, you know, you're dealing with a person on the other end. I just want to beat that person so bad, you know? And it's like,
yeah,
someone gives me.
That's an interesting take.
Right. It's like someone gives me a slight playbook, like, hey, they may try these things. It's almost like sports. Like, you know, you could do all the studying on the other team. What plays do they run? What are the things, knowing your team, what are they going to try to run against you based on your weaknesses? You know, it's like that whole approach. And I kind of take that to heart when it's like, now I step up to the plate and I'm either the coach or the player or whatever role I play. And I'm like, all right, based on what I know, how can I beat them? And so it's almost competitive. And, you know, part of me, it's a nice relief when I look for their said behaviors in my environment and nothing shows up. In a way, it's almost like I have this little mini victory. Like, you know, I might not have something to tell a really cool story about and like show, look why what I'm doing is really cool and good. But inside, I'm like, yeah, like you guys aren't here. And now that I know this works, when you guys are here, I'm ready for you. You know, now I've got my playbook against you kind of scenario. And so, I mean, that's just because I think about problems that way. And like, I seek understanding and I also am competitive. Yeah. So I think that's my biggest driver. And I think it's made me successful to this point. Now, not saying that'll carry me on to any future endeavors, or I might need to add some more things to that list, but I would say those are the two biggest strengths I've leaned on the most.
So first of all,
you and I are different.
One,
you're not.
You see that there, or you look for behaviors that are not in the, your environment. And you think, yeah, they're not here. I think I panic and say, oh man, what are they doing that I'm missing? Two, you see it, or we both see a car engine. You get a screwdriver and a ratchet set, and I get a sledgehammer. I don't know.
Oh, that is very true. You mean it saws off?
I think he means a nuclear bomb.
Right?
But no, so I'm not saying I don't break things. I just probably have a little more careful approaches to breaking things. I'm not like, yeah, you know, if I do this, this might not work. You're like, well, why do this when I can do all of these things at once? Yeah. So,
yeah.
Wow. Right. So, now to kind of like segue into the next phase of the journey, right? So we kind of talked to the beginning, and I'm hoping the people listening are able to cherry pick some really interesting things to they either can relate to or maybe understand some things better. But threat hunting isn't just, hey, I want to be a threat hunter someday, and you just drop in and start doing it, right? There's a lot of kind of growing involved, right? And I think us walking through, like, how do we perceive cybersecurity starting out? How do we even learn about threat hunting? What are our strengths and weaknesses? Some of the things we actually hunted for. I'm hoping that helps create a realistic sense for, you know, how do they start their journey or where are they on their journey, right? From a listener perspective. So I'm hoping that's beneficial, but I want to kind of pivot into the grind, right? Like now the idea here is now we're like actively threat hunting because we kind of know what it is. We've done some trial and error, not saying we're great at it, but it's all about how do we then continue this process? Not just, hey, this was a cool idea yesterday. I did some threat hunting this week and now I'm over it. Now, how do we make it like part of your regime, your function, your role? Or even if it's not, you're not a dedicated threat hunter, I'll be completely honest. If you're able to just use what spare time you do have to do threat hunting, one, it'll grow you as a security professional because you'll just get better at whatever job it is that you do, especially if you're in security operations in general. But two, if you start showing value by doing those things, you might be able to A, help build a program, or B, even maybe even get a role in a program like that and create some, you know, control where you might end up from a job perspective within the same organization. Like, that'd be a really cool thing to say. I've showed the value. Now I'm the threat hunter, or I'm running the threat hunting program. So there's value to that. So, yeah, I kind of open it up. Tom, I guess you've got the first, question for us.
All right, let's kick it off. So, you know, both to both of you guys, how did your awareness or the knowledge of threat hunting, even if it was something you gained in those first handful of questions of kicking it off, how did that change how you do security work overall?
Yeah, if I were to answer this, it's more along the lines of it really changed my approach to how I interpret threat data and like what I actually care about now. My whole paradigm has shifted because, like I said, I lean more towards behaviors and IOCs. And also, data itself, I've become more, I guess, intimate with data in general and understanding nuances in data that I would never have really explored because I wasn't trying to understand things the same way. And then the proactiveness. I would say like the biggest thing would be the proactiveness. like just the awareness of threat hunting really changed where now I wasn't sitting and waiting, because I'll be honest, I mean, and I'm hoping it's still true, because then what I'm saying is true, but I hated waiting for alerts. And when alerts hit and it was an alert I've seen before and it wasn't something new, man, did I hate even working the alerts. Like, there's nothing fun with that. Especially if it's something that you commonly see as a normal activity. So if I could do anything else and being proactive, I feel like I just had so much more value. And so knowing that that was kind of an approach to things, I think that changed just how I started, I guess, doing security work, even if it wasn't dedicated threat hunting. My approach to security and what I thought people should be doing is very different.
What did we break? Where, I forget what the, I think it was something table, where we dropped some level of confidence to test out the sim we were using at the time. I think it was the emerging threats feed, where we dropped down.
Oh, the IOCs for
the RepSM and emerging threats, I think.
Maybe, but we would, like,
that sounds right.
We would case something and say, do not alert for another hour. I forget what, Kastur, you might remember this because you were on the engineering team.
I think you helped build it. Yeah.
But we started, like, because
solution,
we got.
Not the problem.
No, yeah. Not you, the problem. We're always
thanks
a problem.
God.
But we did so many of the do not alert for like an hour that like it was eating up the resources, and like I forget which engineer came in and was like, we gotta stop doing this, we gotta clear this table or so on. But yeah, I remember there was like, oh, look at case number this. This is what it's associated with. This is what it's associated with, and so on.
From a reviewing cases perspective, I remember like it's when you, our solution, if it was something similar, we always said, we'll just reference the case that's the same one so that, you know, we don't have to take as many notes. But that became like the standard for like you to see cases upon cases of reference this. And they weren't referencing like the main case. Sometimes it was the case that references the case, and it was just.
We forgot what the original case number was.
Right. It was a nightmare, right?
But that was our maturity level, right? We weren't really sure how to improve that. At the time.
Yeah, I'll admit, that used to eat me alive. That used to drive me crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I was similar, like, it's like, man, let's solve it. Let's just stop casing these into this. Let's figure it out, you know?
But to go back to the question, sorry, I'll always pull us on side tangents. I've learned that a lot of my assumptions are wrong about what data will look like. I'll go in there and like you read a report, you look at the behaviors, and I can kind of picture in my mind what it's doing or what I should see. And then I go emulate it and I'm off. And it's like, wow, like what? Oh, like that. I thought this was good. I thought this hypothesis was going to be spot on, but I found a bunch of other stuff that is legitimate. And then you start thinking like, wow, like you read the report. And you're like, well, I could have found that. And then you look, you know, you run it in your environment. You're just like, oh, I see why it might have been missed. But it, I guess the word I'm looking for is humbled. Like it humbles me day in and out. I don't know if that's improving. Maybe it's taking things with a grain of salt or, you know, keeping that in the back of my mind, but. Yeah, other than looking at, like you said already, looking at behaviors, knowing where IOCs play a role, not so much in threat hunting, but in like, you know, IOC scans, detection engineering, quick wins. But I've also gotten a process that, to investigate. It's kind of like some that's, from running all the workshops, that I kind of like, if I'm going to, follow a process chain, I know how I'm going to do it, whatever tool I'm using. Or if I'm looking for files being created, I know what event types I'm like, I have my big five. I know what I'm looking for when I enter an investigation. And then I know, I kind of get the idea along the way of what contextual events I'm looking at. Like, and what I mean by contextual event, you know, I like in my mind, I have actionable artifacts and contextual artifacts. Actionable is like, here's a process command line arguments. And if, you know, if you see the argument is modifying a registry key, the contextual information will be a registry event. Like, okay, that tells you that that command line ran and was successful. So it gives you a couple of, you know, other information, like does it have a, you know, that person must have privileges to modify registry keys, and so on. But I think I've been able to like just take the knowledge and look at Intel reports and kind of chunk them into different criteria of a lot faster, and then go through that process of threat hunting and investigating in almost a repeatable, organized manner. Whereas early on, I was just like, we're going to see what we can see.
So you said something that I really liked, and that was you looked at something and you thought, hey, this looks like my guess or my hypothesis as I would see this, you know, as the outcome. And then you were wrong. When you looked at it, you're like, oh, it's slightly different. There's something else I need to be looking for. I think that is something that I also enjoy and learn very fast from. And sometimes I'll even see a behavior that I'm like, oh, that looks like a behavior. And I don't think I've ever seen that before because I've never looked for it specifically. So that's probably what I'm going to hunt for. And I look, I'm like, oh, that's pretty much how every machine works or runs things. And I could find that out very quick. And so then it also changes my perspective on some of the reporting and some of the things they're calling out. So I'm like, okay, so that exists. Now, why are they leveraging that? You know, what does that stem? What does that connect to? What are the follow-on activities? What are the precursors to that activity? Anything there? Like, you know, I start searching around that event because it's usually something that's obviously called out in the report. So I think it's important. But I learned so much about the environment or about how things work by making those assumptions and being wrong. So I actually enjoy being wrong sometimes because it's a learnable moment. So, yeah.
Well, we do like in the threat hunting methodology that we teach and the threat hunting methodology that we preach, we liken it to the scientific method. And I think, I forget which resource I was reading or whatever, and whatever scientist was talking, obviously much smarter than me, they said we use the scientific method to prove our assumptions false. Like, they want it to be wrong. Granted, in threat hunting, I kind of don't want to be wrong because I'm trying to produce something that our customer can use. I don't want to give them something. But you also, you don't want to be right all the time because then you miss out on those learning opportunities.
Yeah,
and you also,
but
you also learn the significance. Like you said, like, why did they call that? Why did they mention that in the Intel report? There's normally this underlying level of significance that I didn't know about until you research it. Like, why are they talking about this registry key changing? Oh, because by default, it's set to a 0. So by setting it to a 1, this is what they enabled. Ah, that is significant. Didn't even know that existed. It's nice. It's constantly learning. It's constantly being proven wrong. But it's life.
It's true. Tom, I don't know if you had anything you want to add, but if not,
go ahead and jump. I guess I'll just a quick note on that. You know, what changed? For me, one of the big things that really changed was understanding that the sky wasn't always falling. Early on in my career, I really had a big fear of being the guy that on my watch, the bad thing happened, right? And I think a lot of security professionals generally carry that with them. And as you know, my knowledge of threat hunting came on, I understood the realm much better in a lot of different facets to where I understand how to, you know, put something's criticality in the right place and not freak out so fast, which would, you know, lead to a lot of high stress, high volume type of problems. So like that I think has been one of the biggest gains because that allows you to then absorb and learn and learn even further. And it just snowballs.
Yeah.
Just for note, both of these gentlemen had hair before they became threat hunters. So just a nice warning for you all out there.
Is that why you're putting on extra hair all over your face so that, you know?
Doing it for you, in solidarity, right? Like.
So, nice little segue. It has nothing to do with that. When you guys have kind of gotten immersed to like, all right, you're threat hunting, you see how threat hunting has made things better for what you do from a day-to-day perspective, whether you're as dedicated or not. I mean, I assume all of us kind of started doing threat hunting to some degree, right? So out of all the things you were doing, because you're actively starting to do more threat hunting, what are some of the things that you specifically did to improve or advance any of the skills or your experience in threat hunting in general? Was there anything that you guys like practice, resources that helped, or, you know, what was it that really made you, I guess, better?
For me, it was, I mean, obviously the hands-on keyboard is important, right? So just constantly doing it, trying it, getting your hands in it, failing, all of that, like the brute force method. There's a lot of different tools out there that can help that might not specifically talk about threat hunting, but you can go at and learn the different pieces of things, whether it be understanding how emulations work, understanding how the red team side works, like a hack the box or something like that. There's all kinds of resources. There's all kinds of training. But I think the biggest thing for me was talking to other professionals. It was like actually like pow-wowing or whiteboarding or working through an idea or a thought, or asking somebody how they're like working through this log data set, or, you know, maybe sitting at a conference and going into a talk, a breakout, and saying, and, you know, hearing what other people are doing, maybe not specifically for threat hunting, but, you know, trying to scrape the pieces of what other specialties are that I could pull from to kind of help me gain experience in an area, right? Like how could this technique help me organize my process? How could this investigation over this actual attack that someone demonstrated, how can I learn from that to build a cleaner hypothesis, right? Like, for me, I think it was just being around other security professionals and bouncing ideas off of them, listening to what people went through, trying to absorb experience so I didn't necessarily have to burn the field to gain it, and I could kind of grow from that. You follow?
Yeah. Lee, what's your take?
I think I got 3 points. One is right along with Kostura, is that gaining more perspective outside your own view is paramount, because you could think that you're the best or at least smart or know what you're doing, and then you go to talk to someone and they present a whole new idea that you may not have thought of. It's just that moment's not humbling, but like when you can lean on people like that and expect this great information that you can take back and be actionable as well, you've just improved on your own.
The other side of that too, Lee, sorry, I'm just interjecting that. Say, the other side of that is you might not know anything, because we generally carry imposter syndrome, right? And you go and you listen to a talk, or you jump in to hear what somebody's saying, and it kind of gives you that bit of validation that, hey, I actually know that. And you gain confidence from it, right?
Absolutely. And another thing is that I like to push the limit of the queries that I can create and use. I love diving into syntax. I love diving into certain tools and testing my ability to write a more complex query that isn't just a this or this and this kind of thing. Like, what other capabilities of the tool can I leverage to help me threat hunt? Sandra, it's all of us. All of us. If you say you beat imposter syndrome, you're either lying or you're retired.
But it's a good motivator, so it's not a terrible thing. It just needs to be checked.
It's our number one driver. Shout out to imposter syndrome. Thanks, everyone. But also trying to learn so I can teach. I try to do presentations. I talk to our customers, and I run trainings, all in the goal of how can I improve myself while improving the community at the same time, because I want to be that resource or I like to be that resource that some people can look to and say, I started here, or this person helped me get this information or my foot in the door, which, hopefully not a self plug, but I've had 2 people on LinkedIn reach out to me over the past couple months saying they finally got a cybersecurity job because they asked me questions where to start. And the little advice I gave them, they got it.
That's like, awesome.
And I was just like, and they're like, thank you, thank you. I was like, no. I was like, I did the easy work. You stuck, I was like, you stuck with it. You put your nose to the grindstone and you showed it. But giving talks makes you research, makes you learn more so that you not only validate, but you have references to what you're talking about. Training. I try to do that as much as I can so that I'm constantly learning as well.
Yeah, I would say my quick answer really is, I think the threat hunting process in itself boiled down is fairly simple, right? So once I kind of learned what threat hunting was and what that process looked like, then the only thing it was lacking was just knowledge and more things. So kind of like what you two alluded to, like once I then started talking to other people or learning the tool sets that I had better, or you know, exploring other types of materials that educated me even better, like all those things kind of just then I was able to layer into the process and the approach I already was practicing when it came to threat hunting, and it made me better. Even today, I mean, that's kind of my approach. Like, we have our internal processes for how we build threat hunts, but I only get better at it as I start to understand more things. And so all I do is figure out when I learn something new, how do I apply that to threat hunting? That process, can it plug in any way? And so that has specifically improved me in threat hunting. But really getting good with the process first, I think, helps you navigate any new skills and knowledge into that. So I think we got one more question, right, on the grand?
I'm going to throw it out there. We got time. We're going to do it. But the question is, what perception from leadership or different business groups within your organization either express their want for threat hunting or even understand the concept? Because this is a tough hurdle to get over, especially if you have someone writing the check. Say, hey, we need X amount of people to threat hunt. But I'm going to post that to you two. So what experience have you had? What knowledge you got with that question?
So what's interesting when you say threat hunting to other business units, when you have to talk, like, because I've had to talk metrics and things, or you talk even to your leadership from threat hunting and they're not fully aware of the distinction of what threat hunting is. They're assuming based on the name you're already doing it. Like, it's not a separate, you know, hey, what do you mean you're not looking for threats? It's like, no, that's not. I mean, that's the words we use and it defines these things. But like, well, shouldn't you always be looking for threats? Like, I don't understand. And that was one of the biggest challenges with having those conversations was really kind of educating that idea that, hey, we actually have been operationalizing alerts and detections from tools that generate that. Now we want to do threat hunting, which is operationalizing data and things that may get past all those tools and detections, right? Like, they're like two separate things. But it was really interesting when, you know, I learned about threat hunting and we wanted to like socialize it on how immediately I didn't think of it as, you know, when people try to boil and simplify cybersecurity when they don't understand it, I was like, well, you're looking for threats. And I didn't make that connection until like I was presenting and talking to people and they're like, well, what is it that you do? I'm like, oh, well, we react and respond to things that we build to try to detect. Well, isn't that threat hunting? No. So that I think is a really tough conversation to have. And that's what's interesting to me when looking at leadership or looking at other orgs across the business when you talk about your programs. And I think that is from the grind perspective is incredibly important, right? And because that's what's going to help you turn that grind into gold, right? Or grind into value is being able to help educate and, you know, prophesize as far as the value of threat hunting.
Yeah. I had a unique experience in a certain case where when we started talking about, and I was in a a leadership role at this point, in an operations group. And, you know, we wanted to start creating a focus on threat hunting. And it was, you know, initially a couple times actually kind of looked at, like you just said a little bit, Scott, but also just like, you know, well, you know, it's cool to have a project, but you know, what's the value, things like that. And, you know, it was a really quick, you know, learn and lesson into some initial leadership stances of, well, they care about ROI. They care about what the spend's going to be, what the time commit's going to be, what resources you're going to need, or what resources are they going to pull from. So, you know, when you went in and started talking about thinking of those notions and revisiting, here's the pitch, here's how we're going to go about something, you start providing that ROI, and it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to find every bad guy that's in our environment, right? That's just, you know, not reality. It would be nice if it was, but that's not reality. So, like, you look at the other things where you can show how it could, at least in my case, how this dedicated effort could spin into the rest of operations. How could it feed back into maybe your intel collections or your internal intel stuff of how you could pull back into your SOC operations for analysts of, this is how our environment works. These are some of the oddities we've seen in the past. Here's some idea of what that is, or maybe we found something bad in it. We've identified visibility gaps. You identify, you know, logging that isn't correct, or maybe parsing into your data repository, your SIM, or your data lake, or whatever it may be. You start pushing out those things that when you do these hunts, here's the results we're going to get from them. And they're going to feed back into the loop. They're going to help find things. They're going to help tune detections. They're going to help generate new detections. And now suddenly you're going to get buy-in. At least in my experience, in my one set of experiences, the buy-in started increasing. And then when you finally like spend that time hunting and you actually find something big, now you're on a roller coaster. Now you're gone, right? But initially when you talk right on the night, you know, at least over the past few years, it's not mainstay. People don't necessarily entirely know what it means. I think you guys have crossed that board a few times too, right? So if the people on the ground aren't necessarily sure how to operate that, you know, leadership might not necessarily be sure either. So they're just seeing it as a dollar or spend. So you kind of got to work around those things. And, you know, in my experience, when I did, I found success.
I think the biggest point here is communication. I think that's the biggest hurdle. Pulley, I'm pretty sure, and probably Kasura, you as well, you're both leadership roles. Being technical and communicating technically is one thing, but being able to speak the business language, like you said, Kasura, is another different battle. You could explain a threat the best way possible that anyone else could, but if you're not tying that to the business objective, how many dollars saved, what's the impact of this, then I think that might be the losing battle constantly. If you can't communicate that, you might just be in trouble. On the other hand, I wish that each time you would find that misconfiguration or you would find that weird thing, or the pen test, right? That should be a win. Like, hey, we were hunting for something and we found something you put there. If they don't recognize that as a win or like as a lucky, then what, you know, what organization are you at? In general, it's tough out there.
It can be for sure.
We feel it with Sandra G.
Yeah. So I was just going to say, we obviously didn't get to the perfect outcome, but I think this is a great segue for Sandra is we're going to have our next episode, December 5th. So keep up with social media, how to sign up. We'll be promoting it, of course. We're going to hit the perfect outcomes of threat hunting. And based on your comments, because I'll tell you what, you win the award for the most active person, Sandra. We're going to address that in the next episode because it falls into the perfect outcome, as well as we'll try to add even more things to help you have those conversation to explain, you know, the things that you have found and why it is important, what it is you're doing. So with that, I really want to thank everyone else for joining. I love talking shop with friends and colleagues. So please, if you like what you hear, check us out on the Apple Podcast, Spotify, or just about anywhere else you actually get your podcast, and leave a good review because it really helps other people discover our podcast as well, which opens up the conversation even larger. And for those that don't know, we also do a brief 30 to 45 minute episode. It kind of hits on, you know, some breaking news topics, intelligence reports, technical write-ups, for the week. It usually airs on Wednesdays. But that's a way for us to really get technical deep dive into some of these things you might care about. So definitely check us out. And I appreciate everybody listening and contributing. So happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.